Good day, and welcome to today's Prevent Connect web conference. This session will be recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. David Lee. Please go ahead, sir.
Hello, everyone. This is David Lee from Prevent Connect, and I'm really pleased to have all of you here to join us for today's web conference, From Girls to Women, Countering Limited Roles for Women Through Norms Change. And this is another web conference as in our series around norms change that we've been doing this year, and it's so great to see so many of you here joining us online. And I see that people have been already writing in where you are from around the country, and we've got people from all over the place, so great to be able to see people coming in from all around the country. Prevent Connect, as you are familiar with, is a program that's funded by the Centers for Disease Control, run by the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and we have a wide variety of activities. Go to our website, www.preventconnect.org, to learn more about our online community. We not only have web conferences like this, but we also have reading clubs that are smaller web conferences to discuss recently published literature around the issues related to violence against women. We also have a wiki. We put out a wide range of podcasts and have e-learning units. Follow the Pulse of Prevention on Twitter at @PreventConnect, and you also can follow our prevention blog over at CalCASA. We have a lot of information, and of course, become a friend with us on Facebook. So social media is indeed what we do, and just if you like your old school, we have a listserv or email group. We have about 1,100 people on that, too, so we have a lot of ways that we're connecting, and so go ahead and join us there. I want to talk a little bit about the technology just so you can all become familiar with it. And I know many of you are very familiar with it, but if we're going to do this really quickly. The first thing to note is that if you look above my head, a little bit to the right of it, there's a little hand. And that's how you raise your hand. I'll draw a little circle where that hand sort of looks, a little purple circle there. So, we got a funny sound. So it's interesting, you're not advancing. But I see. That's where we're going. So can everyone raise their hand, please? I see four people have raised your hand. Go ahead. Everyone raise your hand. We will use the raise the hand feature if you want to ask questions in the presentation. It's a great way to be able to talk to us. Now, many of you have your audio connected to us through your computer, and you're listening to my voice through the computer. If you want to ask a question, the way to ask a question is either in our text chat that I'll talk about in a minute, or you can get on the phone and call us, and the phone number you'll see in that top gray bar, there's a dial-in number, an 866 number, and a password. Go ahead and call in, and then we can be able to hear your voice and join us. So if you are listening to us through the computer, you can't talk through the computer. You only can talk through your phone. So we will be able to do that. So I see that 44 of you raised your hand. I'm going to lower your hands right now. The next part is the questions and answers, and this is a way we can learn a little bit more about who is in our audience. So what I am going to do is find my agenda here, and I'm going to pose a polling question so we can learn about who's in the audience. We see where you are from. Yucca, California, great, and Wyoming, several Wyoming people. That's fabulous. So I am now posting the polling question. The first question I'm going to ask is, have you attended a web conference before today? You have several options. This is the first web conference I've ever attended. The second choice is I've attended web conferences before, and this is the first time attending a Prevent Connect or Prevention Connection web conference. And then if you've attended one to two previous Prevention Connection web conferences, let us know. And if you've attended three or more or are big fans of ours, click that. Let's see how much people. I see more people have. Everyone has not voted yet, but a lot of you have. We're 80% voting. I'm going to share the results with you all. And what you can see is that 40% of you have attended three times or more, so you don't want to hear me talk anymore about how to run technology. And that 21% of you have been on some of them, and 8% of you is the first time you've ever been on a prevention connection, on a web conference at all. Another 15% of you, this is the first time at Prevent Connect. I hope you enjoy this. We are pretty engaging, as you will see. So the second question I want to know is a little bit more about who's in our audience so we can get a range of here. So I'm going to ask the question about what best describes your organization, and what you should be seeing on your screen is, are you a sexual assault agency or coalition, a domestic violence agency or coalition, a dual domestic violence and sexual assault agency or coalition? Are you a health, mental health, or social service organization? Are you education K through 12, education, college, university? Are you with recreation, athletic, or after-school programs? Are you with the faith community? Are you with mental, oh, I had mental health twice, community organization, law enforcement, military, or other? So let's see the results. I'm getting a lot of people sharing that. And what we will see here is that our audience is a third of you are with dual domestic violence and sexual assault agencies, and another 27% of you are with sexual assault or domestic violence agencies. We've got 10% in college or universities, no one from a K through 12. They're not in school now. They don't have that excuse. We have 7% from healthcare and no athletics or after school or recreation and some community organizations and a few others. If you're another, can you write in the text chat what you are just so we can get a sense of who those 2% others are? Municipal government. And, oh, and someone's K-12 and someone's from Southwest Virginia. And tribal TANF program. So great. Thank you. And so were you able to see the results? You are supposed to see the results, but you didn't. I'm sorry, but I'm going to withdraw the question anyway. Because that's our questions we want to ask of who is in the audience. The last piece is that we have our text chat, and you've already been doing the text chat. And this is a way that you'll be able to just write down and share. We keep this open the whole time. We will make a copy of the text chat later on if you want to read this, because a lot of people will share resources. You can put links into this. If the box is too small to read, which it is, you can undock. And the way you do that is there's a box in the upper right-hand corner of your chat box. I'm going to do a little circle of where that is. Click on that box. I'll do a little check there. And that will open up your chat box and make it much bigger and easier to read. And so that's something you can be able to do. And Carla says hi to Maria. So, and now the goal is to get the highs out now so we can focus on the topic that's at hand. This, as I said, is part of a series that we've been doing in our web conferences this year, talking about the theme of norms change. And so what we've already done is several web conferences. We've already talked about the countering a culture of violence through norms change. We've talked about growing boys into men. The session today is going to be about from girls into women. In August, we will be having we will be repeating this session next week. So if you have colleagues who weren't able to attend, let them know we still have some openings for that. So we want to be able to fill that session should be filling up soon, but let people know. We'll be talking about countering the norms around privacy, around control, and social control, and have a great session coming up in August, repeating it in September. And the final one, we'll be talking about my business and looking at how we can combat secrecy and privacy. And I know we're going to be featuring Green Dot as one of the programs that I'll be highlighting. So it's going to be a really great opportunity. So these are our web conferences coming up. Prevent Connect is talks about domestic violence, intimate partner violence, and sexual violence. We look at violence across the lifespan. We try to prevent violence before it happens and make connections to other forms of violence and other issues that are related. And that's what Prevention Connection is about. It's about forming a community of people. Prevent Connect is a national project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, sponsored by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views and information provided in this web conference do not represent the official views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. So disclaimer aside, we are now, I'm really pleased to be able to hand it over to my colleagues at Prevention Institute, who we work really closely with, who will be leading today's session. So we have Christine Chang and Annie Lyles. So take it, Christine and Annie.
Thank you, David. Hey, I wanted to mention the opportunity to do private chat. It seems like after you've all been here, you've made friends, and I thought, I don't know if we talked about how to do private chat.
Well, if you do, it's easy to do private chat. If you, what you do is you just click on in the chat box. You can see a little. I have to now look at how that looks like. There's a thing that's called private chat. You click private, and then you can click on the name of the person you want to send a chat to, and they will get a private chat just between the two of you. We won't know what you're saying. So if you want to be able to talk about what you're going to do for dinner tonight, or share your curriculums, you can do that. But if you share your curriculum, do it on the public one because we would all love to see what you're sharing.
Absolutely. But if you do want to send a note to the colleague or someone you know, feel free to use the private chat to do that. So thank you, David. This is Annie. You can see my picture popping up there in the top. We're so pleased to have you joined us on today's webinar. I also want to welcome back our co-host, Christine Chang.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for the intro, Annie. I'm so excited to be here. How about, okay, let's just get started. This is the third in the series of webinars that we're hosting this year that's focusing on the five key norms that we've identified that influence gender violence and the power of changing norms as a key to prevention. And so during each webinar, thank you, Lily, we had some really great overview building upon foundational understanding of what primary prevention is. Setting that foundation for you all. We've been talking about specific strategies for changing those damaging norms and then examining how we can counter those key norms in order to end gender violence.
Thanks, Christine. So we're also going to be hearing about some exciting success stories from our guests. And through this all, we hope that after 90 minutes, you're going to be able to understand how norms create an environment which gender violence is less likely to occur. We're going to have some examples of success from people and organizations, and hopefully you'll be sharing some examples through the text chat. We're also going to be looking at strategies and indicators. And indicators is a new piece for us to really think about the, you know, how we measure progress in this norms change.
So first off, like we mentioned earlier, we want to make sure that everyone is on the same page, that we're all starting from the same place, and understand really what we're talking about when we talk about primary prevention. We're talking about strategies that occur before violence happens.
Exactly. And for those of you that have been this before, you've seen this continuum. And I like to show it because it gives people a good reminder that we're talking about upfront approaches that take place before violence has ever occurred, and that there's secondary and tertiary prevention, things that happen during the crisis or afterwards to help healing. But we're really focused today on those primary approaches.
Exactly. And, you know, Annie, I think it's really easy for people to confuse a primary prevention approach with services like early intervention for victims and for perpetrators. And early interventions are crucial because they can help alleviate trauma and even potentially prevent future incidences of violence. But early intervention services don't really necessarily make the changes to the broader community and the societal environments that give rise to the violence in the first place.
Right. So while early interventions may help to stop violence once it starts, they don't necessarily prevent violence from starting in the first place. So primary prevention, our focus today is moving far upstream to change the environmental factors. We're going to be talking about things like economic inequalities, mm-hmm. sexism, mm-hmm. Media, marketing practices,
yeah.
The kind of things that shape norms and behaviors of an entire population.
Exactly. So we're really excited to have this conversation with you all. We hope that you'll participate, give us your insight, give us your strategies, give us your indicators, so that we can really talk about those upfront approaches to change environments and the environmental community approach so that girls and boys can really thrive and gender violence is really less likely to occur.
You know, when we use a primary prevention approach, we have to address norms. And so we just wanted to take just a moment and acknowledge that norms really help us explore social factors that contribute to violence against women and gender violence.
Exactly. We know that social and community environments are really essential in shaping behavior on a fundamental level because we all experience social norms in our own lives, and they shape our behavior, like what's socially acceptable to do in any given certain situation.
Right. We experience different social expectations, you know, depending on, you know, how you should act at work compared to at home, right?
Or, like, at a sports game or at a wedding.
Exactly. So face paint at the sporting event, absolutely okay. At the wedding, a little bit more questionable, sure. But go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think norms are so often ingrained in what we do and how we live on a day-to-day basis that we don't talk about them or even really necessarily notice that they're even there.
Right. I mean, people generally conform to those around them, right? That's human nature. They do it in their behavior and thinking. And so much of the work in the field has been really to get people to stop and start critiquing those things, those norms they take for granted, because we start to understand that they're perpetuating gendered violence.
And the good news, I think, when we're discussing norms and what we have been discussing norms up until now in our webinars is that norms do change.
Mm-hmm.
And we've really identified five norms in this field that will decrease the likelihood of gender violence from ever occurring once they are addressed.
Exactly. So here are five norms to think about changing. The general acceptability of violence or cultural violence, a narrow definition of masculinity, limited roles for women, the value placed on power, and the idea that gendered violence is a private or secret matter. So hopefully these sound familiar to you.
And we've, as we mentioned before, we've been focusing on these key norms in our webinar series this year. And today's focus, just to make sure that you guys are all in the right place and in the right webinar, today's focus is the limited roles for women.
Great. So let's get to it. You know, whether we're male or female affects what people expect of us and how we're treated. That's pretty obvious.
And I think it's also common knowledge that messages that girls and boys get about what it means to be a man or a woman can increase or decrease the likelihood of gender violence from occurring.
Exactly. So we're going to be looking in the next session about how to expand these ideas of the role of women in society, promising strategies, indicators, things that can help broaden the role for women as a way to prevent gender violence.
I think when we think about limited roles for women as a norm, we're saying that women and girls are brought up to behave in a certain way or play a specific or, you know, specific limited roles.
Right. That's right. I mean, you can see from this slide, the top image is not that jarring. We see this all the time. The description, this is from Toys R Us, Dirt Devil Play Vacuum, just like moms. And that's an example of a really subtle way women are encouraged. The bottom one, and I think I made it small because I find this advertisement so incredibly jarring, is a more overt, and it's a really a much more damaging norm, right? We're training girls into this narrow definition of femininity that often includes stereotypical girly characteristics such as being agreeable or being a passive in ways that, you know, don't feel so offensive, like the vacuum, and hopefully the ones like Dolce & Gabbana ad that are really problematic.
Now, all girls growing up with social training and expectations about what it means to be a woman, but the messages that girls get are often depending on a lot of different factors. For example, girls can, you know, receive different messages and expectations about womanhood depending on different things, like different things that influence their life, right? Class status, their ethnicity, or the number of generations they've been in the U.S.
Right, you know, and it's always important to emphasize that in each group, there's examples of narrow definitions of what it means to a woman, and in each group, be it class, ethnicity, status, there's also women resisting and reframing narrow definitions of their identity. So we don't want to say that it's a, you know, fill-in-the-blank kind of thing, that this is really an opportunity in all different groups to really counter these limited roles for women. I want to just say in a moment, if you're interested in having an experiment with your group, I tried to get the images for this webinar today by going to Google Images and typing in the word girls. I got 182 million images, right, from my Google search, and the first four pages were not girls. They were all adult women, and they weren't dressed. And it was a diverse group of women, right? And so I'm going through. I do have to admit on page four there was an image of the Golden Girls, which was a nice break to the scantily-clad adult women. But on page 13, I found this image I put in the bottom corner of these girls that I felt looked a little bit normal, right?
Yeah.
And when I clicked on it, the description is nerdy girl.
Wow.
Right? And so, and you see from that one, it's primarily, and it's hard to tell in this size, a Caucasian audience. And so when you think about limited roles from world, you know, white women do involve a different privilege as kind of what they can be in positive ways. But we know that it affects every group and that every group has the opportunity and women really resisting this this limited role.
And I think it's good to point out, Amy, like in this conversation, we're referring not only to the Western models or the dominant group models,
right,
that you mentioned, but we're really touching upon the diverse upstream environments of all our communities.
Right. So, you know, in these communities, we have the opportunity to go upstream, change damaging norms portrayed and experienced by girls and women. We have the right to ask, what sort of environment are girls being raised in? How are their behaviors influenced by norms and expectations? When and how is acting like a girl or behaving like a woman being taught to the next generation? A lot of people identify that there's important work to do in the family area, and we really want to push you today and think.
And exactly, there's huge opportunity there, and if we want to change environments and we want to change norms, we have to take that community-level approach again.
Right, we can't just stop at families. So concretely, let's start with the current environment and get your fingers all warmed up here. How are you seeing limited definitions of femininity being taught and reinforced in your community? What's that upstream environment looking like? And you can see we just put that question into the text, And hopefully.
Time to get your fingers warmed up, everyone. Reality TV.
I always tell Christine I only watch it for research purposes, but I am very concerned about the kind of brand and what's happening on the Kardashians right now and what that's saying about women and the kind of critique. And it seems like it's their whole plot this season, let alone Jersey Shore and what's going on that TV.
There's just too many now to keep track of.
Well, there's some lower pay was another one that I talked about for Scales for Women.
Women in elected positions. I like that face.
Right. Several talks about faith has come up.
Natalie mentions the Disney films. Absolutely. Especially that goes to some of our youngest women.
Ooh, sexualized photos of women athletes. That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and heterosexism. And I think that's an important piece to put in and think about how those two things are tying together. Toddlers and tiaras, advertisements. Date auctions, Sarah, that's a really interesting one to put up. They're auctioning off women for a good cause. And I think they also do it for men, too. And you think about that doesn't make it okay, right? If we're commodifying both groups, that doesn't make it okay.
Marriage promotion, that's interesting.
Podium girls for Tour de France. And I think we see that concept of podium girls represented in a lot of different ways, whether it's videos or events.
The expecting baby girls to be in pink or purple.
Yes.
I had to fight for a pink hat for my son when he was born.
And those of you will not see it, but David is wearing a purple shirt today. Thank you, David,
so
for living the life. All right, so keep those things keep coming in. And I think you guys have a great there's more than enough here to work on changing this norm. So let's go ahead and take it to the next level.
All right, so taking it to the next level, how do narrow roles for women is characterized by all things people mentioned, advertising, athletics, elected positions, local government. How do these things make gender violence more likely to occur?
I think you get a lot of pushback from people, and I chose this picture. This is actually Miley Cyrus's father giving an interview when she got a lot of pushback because at the Nickelodeon Teen Choice Awards, which is really for preteens, she did a stage performance that included a pole and a pole dance. And her father's saying, look, Miley just loves to entertain people. This isn't a problem, right? And hopefully you're shaking your heads like Corey is next to me. But, you know, and I think, you know, let's take a minute because the people that we're trying to work with and change these norms don't necessarily see their link to gender violence. And so, you know, Corey is here from Team Up for Youth. And go ahead and let's put their pictures up here. You can go ahead. And Megan we have on the phone. And I thought maybe we could have our guests just start off responding to that question, which is not an easy question, but what are kind of some of your thoughts? And Corey is here in our studio here in Oakland, and Megan is with us by phone. So maybe, Corey, you can start us off with some thoughts of when you see that slide and her father's response that, you know what, she's just entertaining. You know, what comes up to your mind?
Hi, everyone. So I think the thing that's most frightening about that is how acceptable it is and how the lack of thinking that goes behind it and then kind of the residual effect of that. So if it's okay for those images to be out there and then for really young girls to see it, what they're learning about themselves as they come into young womanhood, and like that's what they're learning to be. And so I find those kind of images to be really damaging because that's kind of the training, the pre-training.
Right.
What it means to be a girl and what it means to be a woman.
And you think about that in the context of young girls and, you know, what we hope for our young girls, right? And that concept of pole dancing and being a sexual object, you know, is reinforced in so many ways. We hate to see it reinforced in something that's just entertainment.
Right. And I mean, I think the other piece is that not only is it what's teaching girls who they should become, but, like, if you don't fit into that, that there's a lot of pressure to fit into that, and if you don't, there are a lot of consequences also.
Yes.
And so it's both sides, like the pressure and the consequences for not fitting in.
Right, mm-hmm. That's the stigma. Megan, do you want to jump into this, and what do you think when you see that image coming up, and how would you respond to families in the community?
Well, you know, it's clearly a disturbing image, and what's particularly disturbing for me is the lack of strong female role models in the media for girls, especially young girls. And, you know, Miley Cyrus's Hannah Montana, and lots of 8, 9, 10-year-olds are watching that show. And so this is what they're supposed to aspire to be or to do. I mean, that's particularly disturbing for us. And you see this as a theme among child stars who turn into, you know, semi-porn stars, and, you know, you see them on the cover of Rolling Stone licking ice creams together, or you see Amanda Bynes on the cover of, you know, GQ or Esquire magazine looking sexy, or Lindsay Lohan isn't teasing type of headlines on the magazines, and it's disturbing because it's part of a, you know, it's part of a theme. It's part of sort of how girls grow up in our culture now. They become pole dancers, they become sex objects, and that's why it's particularly disturbing to us, you know, working with young girls, is that these are the role models that they, you know, these are the role models that they're identifying for themselves.
Definitely.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, you know, it's hard for people sometimes, and I think as a feminist, you want women to be able to acknowledge their sexuality, but you want that to be not co-opted, right? Mm-hmm. And you want them to have these, as you mentioned, you know, strong female role models that aren't sexual, and that girls that are in the Mickey Mouse Club, that are, you know, Hannah Montana, that are seen as really, you know, these powerful, outstanding young women, don't transition through puberty to become sex objects. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a role model for our children.
And it's certainly a balance between, you know, that healthy sexuality, because we do want, you know, girls to grow up to have healthy notions of sexuality, and you just don't see that in the media.
Yeah,
definitely.
Well, let's open it up to our guests. I can see that we already have some great comments coming in about, you know, other examples. And we'd love to hear from you all. You know, how do you talk about this when you talk to folks about limited gender roles contributing to gender violence? I think I shared the story before when we had shown a picture of Miley Cyrus. People said, well, so what? She's wearing a miniskirt. I wear, you know, miniskirts. The 70s, the whole part of, you know, becoming a woman, you know, is that you can wear a miniskirt. And we'd love to hear kind of how you tie that in to gendered roles or violence. Clearly, wearing a miniskirt isn't the problem, right?
Definitely. Great. I think people are starting to respond to this one.
Right.
How so normalization.
So
I think,
go ahead and write in, so text chat in, how does normalization of limited female gender roles contribute to gendered violence?
Girls shouldn't be fighting back. That's an interesting way to put it, too.
Right. And I think Tara's point in here about dehumanization, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if women's bodies are objects, then they're not human, and you can hurt them, and you don't have those same things.
And Michelle just mentioned exactly what Corey was talking about, was that girls need to fit in, and, like, if they feel that pressure that if they don't belong, then what are they? Who are they?
Right. Victim blaming I saw popped up, and it's coming up again, and I think that's interesting. You know, this is a woman's role. If she does this, you know, it's not a male's responsibility for what she did. She asked for that,
mm-hmm.
rather than understanding kind of the role of men in preventing gendered violence.
Melanie mentions that putting the risk reduction is only on women to prevent themselves from being assaulted.
I get another email about not wearing a ponytail, I don't know what I'm going to do. I just feel like we've gone beyond that, people.
We live in a patriarchal society, Tasha says.
Comment earlier about being the object of the male gaze.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you think about what that means. If your goal is to be the object of the male gaze, then your goal is, you know, to be beautiful and your intelligence isn't there. All those other things that tie into
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
Mimicking dressing for older girls, absolutely.
Other girls judging and calling each other a hoe.
Right? So as young women replicate and internalize these messages, they can be some of the people that really, really translate this norm.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And sexy equals power. I think that's probably a really great two-word summary of what we're talking about when we're talking about limited roles for women.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right, so let's keep going in this vein, and I think what I want to do is we're going to go over to Megan, and Megan is with Hardy Girls and Healthy Women. She's their executive director, and we want to give you some examples. You know, both of our guest panelists are working to change norms and expand the roles for women in community, and we just really want to thank Megan for joining us and welcoming her. Hardy Girls really counters limited roles for women by challenging gendered stereotypes, and we wanted to give you a chance to talk, Megan, a little bit about how that goal is incorporated into your day-to-day work.
Well, thank you. We are a 10-year-old nonprofit, research-based, and we're empowering girls with knowledge, critical thinking skills, and a platform to drive social change. So that means not just talking with girls about what's wrong with the limited roles of gender, or in particular with the media, but empowering them to do something about it. So we're interested in providing programming that supports girls in their critique of the culture, and that gives them opportunities to expand their horizons and to challenge gender stereotypes, and giving them opportunities for leadership and social activism. We know, and you'll see the slide right here, that when girls reach adolescence, and many of you who work with girls know this, they're confronted with ideas of impossible female beauty. They lose connection with what they know. Their self-esteem drops. They have confidence issues. They lose their voices. And their dreams go from, you know, as a young girl, 6, 7, 8 years old, of being an astronaut to getting a boyfriend or being popular or being thin. So, and that's a real issue. And so what we're focused on is preventing that from happening before girls reach adolescence by shoring them up. And then when they're in adolescence, we focus on connecting girls with each other and encouraging them to work in coalition around a lot of these issues, such as violence, such as, girl fighting, such as healthy notions of sexuality, et cetera.
And Megan, we had a lot of great discussion going on in the text chat, as mentioned, and we know that gender stereotypes about female aggression right now are a hot topic with the rise of mean girls and queen bees.
Yeah, you just mentioned girl fighting.
Exactly. What's your take on the norms around girls and their relational aggression?
Well, I think that there is this popular idea that girls are inherently mean or catty or backstabbing or you can't trust girls, which is entirely untrue. But girls are learning this behavior. It's not inherent. Girls are learning this behavior from their media. You see girl fights on, television for all different age groups. You can't walk through the grocery checkout line without, seeing the latest cat fight or Brangelina scandal. So, this has become normalized through our pop culture media.
Bad Girls Club.
Yeah, and Bad Girls Club, exactly. I mean, even shows like Desperate Housewives it's a very popular show among 13, 14-year-old girls. And Gossip Girl, of course, is another one of those shows where you see a lot of distrust and girl fighting and mean behavior. And what we found, I mean, we work with girls every day. We listen to girls. We ask them what's going on in their lives, and they're most girls are not like that at all, but by putting forth this image, we're just enforcing it for girls. So we're focused on creating safe spaces where girls can work together, where they can focus their energy on something aside from each other in a competition between each other. And this is especially important to do with girls once they've hit adolescence.
Yeah. I know that, your organization is working to shift the way people also approach the work with girls. It's not just kind of the amazing content you did. I read Lynn Michael Brown's speech, which is on your website, and I think, Billy, could you put a link up to it? I sent it over to you. And I want to read what she said because I found it incredibly inspiring, and I encourage folks to look at that. She said, we have to shift our focus away from self-esteem, depression, or eating disorders, the symptoms of individual stress and distress, and widen the lens to consider the social and political landscape in which girl comes of age. She really challenges us to not just create hardy girls, but a hardy environment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you're talking about. How does that play out in program development for folks on the ground thinking about shifting from, girls to environment?
Well, first of all, we have to start from a position of strength. We can't just make this assumption that all girls are a certain way because there's a wide diversity of girls and girls' experiences. But we have to also, as adults working with girls, examine our own assumptions and biases and really understand the systems that are at work to keep girls infighting and girl fighting and that sort of thing. What's really important is to provide a safe space free of judgment for girls to operate, for girls to do a lot of this critical thinking, for them to examine gender stereotypes, and then also to engage their energy, as I said before, in doing something about it. Because, especially 12, 13, 14-year-old girls have this really, and boys have this keen sense of justice and fairness. And so if we can engage that frustration and anger in a productive way and get them focused on changing their communities for the better, we found at Hardy Girls that's the way to go.
Well, I really encourage folks to look at your website. You have some amazing resources there on how to approach this issue. I want to give you a chance to talk about the Spark Summit, but we also, I think, Christine, do we want to?
Well, we wanted to actually open it up to the audience. If there's anybody out there who wants to raise their hand and ask Megan a question, we'd love to hear from you all. find out some more about all the great work that Megan and her group have been doing. Thank you.
You can also put a text chat and send in text chat if you have a question, or you can raise your hand by just picking the hand that's above Christine's picture.
All right. And while people get their questions ready, Megan, do you want to talk just a minute about the Spark Summit?
Absolutely. I mean, we touched on earlier the challenge of working with girls today in a world in a country where sexuality is so narrowly defined for girls. The Spark Summit is actually an effort that's come out of the 2007 American Psychological Association report, task force report on the sexualization of girls, which found that, you know, it's no surprise to all of us that the sexualization of girls is really prevalent, especially in pop culture media. Every type of media that was studied, they found clear evidence of it. And so the summit, one of the things that the task force called for, that report called for, was a grassroots campaign for change to push back against sexualization, but also to put forward healthy notions of sexuality for girls. And so the Spark Summit is a summit specifically to challenge the sexualization of girls. It's an activist summit where girl activists, thought leaders, researchers, program providers will get together on a day to speak out and push back so that we can demand healthier notions of sexuality for girls in the media.
Thanks. And, you know, Bill, you were talking just about how girls are represented in the media. We wanted to put this image up here that you shared with us. You know, I have a question coming from...
Cliff. So as folks kind of look through this, maybe we can have you respond to Cliff's question about how we engage boys and men in norms change around limited roles for women.
I think that is a fabulous question, and there's no question that that boys and men can play a preventative role here. You know, the majority of boys and men are not perpetrators at all, and so we need to certainly support programs that for boys that engage boys in doing the same thing we're asking girls to do, which is to think critically about gender stereotypes. We have a wonderful program here in Maine called Boys to Men, which is focused on sort of dissecting that notion of masculinity and reducing violence through, you know, talking with boys about what sexism is and what and where gendered violence comes from.
Great. Well, and you'll be able to hang on for a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
Great. So if folks have more questions, we can keep going. And I think we have some more strategy examples from your organization coming up in our strategy discussion in the next session.
Yes, we definitely do.
Great.
And I appreciate the shout-out about Axe and how problematic their advertising campaign is. Thank you, Paul.
So thank you so much, Megan, for your wonderful input. And it's my pleasure to introduce our second guest who is sitting right here with us in our Oakland studio. Corey, your organization is called Team Up for Youth, but your new initiative, Get in the Game, is designed especially for girls. Why the focus on girls, and how do girls and women benefit from sports?
So our new initiative, The Game Plan, focuses solely on getting girls, specifically in low-income communities, involved in sports. And luckily, we can see in many communities that girls have much more access than they used to sports in affluent neighborhoods. However, this is not the case at all in low-income communities. And so we are making a really big concerted effort to bring attention to that and really create opportunities for young girls to have access to sports programs.
I like that.
I know you talk about on your website you have some kind of benefits for girls to sports. So if we're thinking about, you know, challenging those limited roles, you know, what's the benefit for young women in playing sports?
Sure. So sports, unlike many other outlets, really helps young people to be embodied, to experience themselves in a strong, positive way, to experience being physically assertive. And I think especially when we're talking about girls and violence, this is such a key piece. How do we help young people grow up in their bodies and feeling good about their bodies and feeling that they have the right to be in their bodies and to take up space? And I think sports, that's one of the biggest benefits for girls. And, of course, there are many other benefits for girls and for boys around health, you know, just having better health and feeling, you know, and stuff around academics. But in terms of this conversation, the thing that keeps coming up for me is how it helps girls be in their bodies and take up space.
Yeah, I think for me, I was an athlete in high school, and I'm not an athlete as a primary identity, I would say.
just someone that I really loved being with a team of women that were doing things together, and I loved the whole identity of being on a team. And I think it blew my parents' mind when I decided to play sports since I had never played sports. But when you say that, that kind of taps into me that I loved the socialization, I loved having this female coach that was with me, and I can really see the benefit of that kind of in preparing me to be assertive and to be, you know, thoughtful and have this cadre of women that are helping.
I would add to that that, you know, sports as a physical medium helps girls get in their bodies. However, it really counts on the role of the coach. And so mm-hmm. you have, like mm-hmm. you were talking about, you have a female coach who's a role model who's being really intentional about empowering girls and translating lessons on the field to off the field, then you have this really, really rich experience, and girls can take those lessons back to them in the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the things that we emphasize at Team Up, like how do you help train coaches and work with both female and male coaches to help them translate life lessons. So the whole thing of like going after the ball in sports, how does that translate in girls' lives off the field? Mm-hmm. Really important.
That's really interesting, and I mean your approach to engage the girls and the women who are, and men who are coaching, it seems very like comprehensive in nature. Mm-hmm. And so, what made you decide to explore policy, like, and that policy as a strategy?
Sure. So the game plan is a really large umbrella initiative, and one piece is the programmatic piece, like actually creating sports programs. And then it's really clear that that's not enough. You can't just create sports programs and girls will come because there are so many barriers. Like we've been talking about mm-hmm. so many messages about what's okay and not okay for girls to be doing, especially when we're talking about low-income communities.
Mm-hmm.
And so we focus a lot on constituency building and also on really following through on policies that exist or pushing policies that need to be there. So, for instance, AB 2404 really is like the public version of Title IX. So how do you make sure there are girls' programs happening in rec centers around the country,
mm-hmm.
right, and so or around the state? And so really one of the things we're really looking at is like how do we help hold recreation centers accountable for mm-hmm. that and help them set up programs so they're following through on the policies that are in place to support girls.
Yeah. You know, what have been some outcomes or some lessons learned? I think, you know, having a sporting program that's doing this work would be such a great partner for a lot of our sexual violence or domestic violence, you know, agencies. This could be a really interesting collaborative. What would you advise someone that was thinking about kind of taking this on as a prevention strategy?
I think one of the big things is that you can't work in isolation, which you all know because you can't mm-hmm. do your work in isolation, but mm-hmm. we can't set up girls' sports programs without people being on board and having champions. And one of the things we were talking about earlier, Annie, is the idea of having fathers as champions and really getting
right.
them involved and invested in their girls' well-being. And once you have fathers who are, like, you know, kind of pushing that agenda forward, it's easy. It actually is easier to move things forward
mm-hmm.
because, again, their role in the family unit and in society, and that they can bring kind of communities along.
Yeah. We want to take the last minute here to invite you guys to ask some questions. So if you want to raise your hand by clicking on the icon, you could ask Corey a question, or if you want to put something into the text chat, you get asked a question. The images you're seeing are actually from Team Up for Youth, and I really have to appreciate your website. It's so refreshing to see young women, women of color, you know, they're competing, but they're also, you know, it's really so much focused on this team play, right?
I saw a lot of, I mean, there's been a lot of themes that have been going on in the text chat, and I
mm-hmm.
think that one theme has been recognizing the value of the sports, but recognizing that some girls aren't interested in sports, and that we need to create those environments that are going to get those positive pieces in not just sports, but in other activities, was one thread that I saw. And the other thread that I saw was another barrier for sports is around the homophobia, and about that for women and girls who participate in sports will be seen as being a lesbian mm-hmm. because they participate.
Yeah, that's huge. It comes up whenever we do trainings on girls in sports. It's always one of the hot topics, and people want to pretend that's not there and not a barrier, and it's huge. And we see especially older girls dropping out of sports, even if they have this really incredible sense of identity as an athlete, they will drop out because they either are gay or because they're afraid of being viewed as being gay. And I think
mm-hmm.
that is something
that hasn't been taken out of the closet yet. We don't talk about that publicly and haven't tackled that in a smart way as a society yet at all. It's a huge issue, I agree.
Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and transition it and think about...
There was another thread mm-hmm. that Jennifer just brings up, which is an issue. There's an issue of cost, and there's also the issue about why people... people don't participate in sports after school is often the safety and that they need to mm-hmm. be able to get home. So some of those other economic and class around our environment barriers for sports.
So I can speak to one of the ways that Team Up for Youth has tackled that, which is that we help organizations in low-income communities set up free programs because they do have to be free or they have to be very low-income or they're not accessible to those families. And so... making them accessible. And then, in terms of the safety issue, which I know is really huge in the communities we work in, like how prioritizing finding the space and having the partners in the communities who are going to, ensure that this space is safe. But those, again, when we talk about barriers and when we talk to families, those are two of the big things that come up and we're constantly struggling with and working with communities to kind of figure out.
This is a good example of that, you can't just do a program, right?
Right.
It has to be a comprehensive approach.
Right.
You have to have multi-sectors at the table in order to really change a norm and to be effective and sustainably, preventing violence against women
exactly.
and, promoting all those wonderful things that sports prevent.
Can I just add one other thing in terms
yeah.
of this conversation about girls in sports? Research has showed that girls who don't participate in sports by the time they're 10 or 12 won't participate when they're older. And so, again, when we're talking about strategies, the younger we can get girls involved in sports and the younger we can hook them and help them find passion for, the more likely they're going to continue to have this outlet. And I think when we're talking about kind of the development of femininity and what it means to be a girl and a woman, we can actually reach younger girls more easily, right, because they're not up against the pressures of what it means to be a woman as much yet. And so really targeting the younger groups and then, kind of ushering them through adolescence through this medium.
Oh, that's great. Well, I think that we'll keep this discussion going. We actually have some more strategies that we're going to highlight in this next section. But let's use the next 10 minutes to generate some strategy ideas that counter narrow roles for women.
Great. So as some of you may know out there, the Spectrum of Prevention is a tool created by the by Prevention Institute that has been used to develop that comprehensive approach that we've been talking about all along, that comprehensive approach that really does shift community norms.
As some of you know, the spectrum has been used, as Christine said, to shift those norms. So let's start with the three levels at the bottom of the spectrum, individual skills, community education, and provider training. And we're going to go to that next slide. Great. So here's three examples that we pulled out, and you're going to see Team Up for Youth there again on the right. But programmatically, we've seen success in universal curriculums and peer mentoring on the topics of things like self-image, conflict resolution. These are the things you've been mentioning, I think, a lot in the text chat. Things that promote healthy relationships, especially in schools or in after school.
Exactly. And it's also effective to offer community skill building on topics like media literacy, age-appropriate communication, conflict resolution skills, relationship building. These are all very – wanted to mention Killing Us Softly 4 has just
mm-hmm.
been released with wide acclaim.
Yeah, so be sure to go check that out if you haven't seen it. It's the new updated Jean Kilbourne, Women in the Media. Expect Respect is a long-time evidence-based project that not just trains teens but also how trains the providers to think about, how to decrease sexual harassment and relationship violence in schools. And then we highlighted Team Up for Youth. I saw on your website, Corey, that the Team Up for Girls is going to recruit and train 750 new women coaches by 2011.
That is so exciting.
Yes, we are. We're gonna recruit them, train them, and then place them in after-school programs. We really believe that girls need female role models. They need
Definitely.
Women who are trained to help bring those life lessons onto the court and off the court.
Yeah.
Well, it's a great you're supporting adult women and
yeah.
taking that kind of. I'd be really intimidated to be a coach. I'm sure I could be, and yet having that support in an organization that kind of. Is training me, recruiting me to do that would just make such a difference.
I can sign you up right now if you want.
I know. I was like, oh, no, this is being recorded.
Great. So moving on, we want to hear back from all of you out there. What are strategies that you all know at the individual or community or providers or all three that counter the limited roles for women? Get some good feedback from you all.
great. I saw some examples earlier, and I think Jeff put in the Coaching Voice to Men is a great, great project at a Family Violence Prevention Fund. They've had a long-time success. Jobs and education are possible. Absolutely. I think there's some really there's been a lot of work focusing on economic development, mm-hmm. but a lot of it's in construction with high-risk boys or green economy, and it's usually boys. And I think it'll be interesting to see how we tie women in mm-hmm. And young girls into kind of the new economy.
Getting a lot of feedback about engaging men and boys at all those levels. Very
right.
true. Discuss that.
I saw earlier, too, the Let's Move initiative and thinking about how there's kind of gender equity within that. That'll be an interesting
I
one.
I love it. Somebody just said spare change the youth theater group, theater troupe to local Planned Parenthood changing gender roles. I love it. I'm a big theater fan.
Okay. The Girl Scout troop is skipping the Little Mermaids. There's an example of some advocacy work.
Great. Mentoring.
Right, and a lot of Girl Scout values actually are going to be really resonate, you know, as an organization can really resonate with what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Oh, Lori is going to be training athletic teams in Expect Respect.
Oh, that's
exciting.
A great connection. See, Team Up for Youth, you guys have some new curriculum to adopt. and non-traditional career workshops, absolutely. Love your body and body health image.
Social media campaigns and Rotary Club.
Oh, and Sopmore. You know, Sopmore, so Roptimist, I always say that wrong. They actually have a website, Expect Respect, that I accidentally ended up on when I was looking for the curriculum that had some really interesting messages for about relationship violence and preventing teen gang violence. So that's okay. Great. All right, well, let's keep going. Let's keep the conversation going. Keep those strategies coming in. We hold on to these text chats. And so all the conversation and all the suggestions are really valuable.
So, Annie, and, you know, we've been talking about the sexual prevention. We've got to point out that a lot of the focus, you know, nowadays, we have great resources and a lot of programs out there. At the first three levels of the spectrum, we have a lot of individual-based community education providers-level work being done. Now we're kind of moving into a little lesser-known territory with these top three levels of the spectrum of prevention. And now we're going to talk about fostering coalitions and networks. And this involves people coming together to share that information and resources. But the most successful coalitions really do go further.
And I think this is a key, as you know, Corey pointed out, with Team Up for Youth, you can't just put a program in place or just educate the providers. If you don't have this coalition together, you know, to address barriers, it's really hard to work. We've seen people, coalitions, you know, develop rapid response media networks to respond to breaking news. We've seen them pursue joint funding together. We went ahead and pulled up an example, and I think you've probably heard of this one before.
I love this example, actually. And an interesting example of this level for fostering coalitions and networks is Take Back the Music, which is a campaign that was launched by Essence Magazine to engage hip-hop artists in dialogue and education about sexism and misogyny in the music lyrics and videos, and that connection to sexual violence. And actually, the image that we have up here is three of the winners for this, or three of the top winners for the hip-hop songwriting contest. And it was really a conjunction between Essence Magazine, it was working with Berklee College of Music over on the East Coast, and local officials in the community.
Right. And I think this is an interesting one because this was in 2006, I believe, and Essence has just taken it off their website. So if you're interested in an advocacy piece, there's no longer a Take Back the Music link anymore. And I think Berklee College has stopped their contest as of last year. And there's other, you know, initiatives going on thinking about this. You know, Beyond Beats and Rhymes is one of the most amazing documentaries that come out. If you haven't seen it and you like hip-hop or you're working with teens, you should definitely check it out. I just found out that they have an edited version for high school use, and some of the stuff isn't as appropriate. And I see some strategies that are coming in. Corey, did you want to make a comment?
No, I'm just reading people's comments down here about cheerleading not being covered under Title IX.
No.
Oh.
Which is, yeah, it's one of the biggest controversies in our office. Is cheerleading a sport or not? And how does it expand how we imagine girls and how does it limit it?
Right. Mm-hmm. And you think about that, that's something, you know, if you want to make activism on that point in that discussion, you have to bring in that broader community, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not an internal discussion in terms of changing those norms. Absolutely. All right, well, let's turn it over to you and give you a little bit more time, you being the audience. Limited roles for girls and women, scoring soccer goals, perhaps coalition and network level. I think that you've given some examples, but let's turn it over and I can focus a little bit more on this text chat. What I noticed is that there's a little bit of pause as you guys get, because the answers coming in are complex and thorough.
Mm-hmm.
The level of discussion in this text chat is fabulous. I can't wait to kind of sit back and read it later on today.
I keep getting a little distracted because I want to see it, but there's so much going on, but I'm really intrigued. I think people are coming with some great responses.
Well, the first one from Lori is talking about the coalition with the Rape Crisis Centers and the schools to prevent sexual violence.
Right.
I think this now speaks to how do we integrate athletics, and do we think about those
mm-hmm.
organizations in a way.
And she thinks they're collaborating with faith communities as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Oh, and Tara's giving some advice on cheerleading. Great. Recognition ceremonies for women athletes, that's wonderful. Empowerment groups, great.
Court services unit, Janice is mentioning rec centers, low-income apartment buildings to provide healthy relationship workshops. That's really interesting.
I know that the National Hispanic Alliance for Health is doing some work about soccer fields in urban communities pilot projects, too. I thought that was an interesting coalition example that have a health group is interested, and then now we think about violence against women groups might want to support something like that.
That's great.
And there's such different perspectives, too, because their lens may be about the health, quote-unquote,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, countering obesity or, like, you know, keeping active and healthy, but it also is tied to violence against women.
I love Gail Girls as Grantmakers, a program in Pittsburgh where girls actually get to decide where money goes to their community.
Nice. Oh, awesome. We're like, whoa. And we got a Family Justice Center, which is absolutely a coalition and network model. So let's keep those coming in. And using
philanthropy.
Wow. That's a great idea. I hadn't heard about that before. I'm really glad you all shared that. Huh.
Great. So moving on, we're going to keep going ahead with the spectrum of prevention. We're going to move into the top two levels of the spectrum, which is changing organizational practices and influencing policy and legislation.
And Michelle has kicked us off with an organizational practice banning cell phone use in the schools in order to decrease cyberbullying, which is a great connection, right? Because academically there's a lot of interruptions, but you could also probably get some of the violence against women advocates around that, or youth development violence advocates around that as well.
I think that's a great one.
All right, so let's look at some more examples. Lily, do you want to take us to the next slide? Great. So there was just a report released about family-friendly benefits, and we haven't really talked about benefits so much today or about the family unit, but what they found is between 2006 and 2010, paid maternity leave has actually decreased. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, as we've been discussing the role of men, mm-hmm. paid paternity leave has increased, and it's slight, but it's interesting that I think those trends, and those are kind of some organizational practices to think about as well.
Mm-hmm.
Megan, you know, I think we really wanted to focus on you and some of your work. You have some great examples.
Yeah, Megan, if you could share with us how you've institutionalized the girls' voices in an organization's leadership, that'd be really great, this Girls Advisory Board.
Absolutely. I love talking about our Girls Advisory Board. It's a group of teen girls in 8th through 12th grade. We actually have 13 members now, and they come from all over the state of Maine. And the purpose of the program was really for us, as the organization grew, to really provide a space where we could get feedback from girls, where they could give us feedback, unsolicited and solicited, feedback on our practices, our programs, our events, and our overall mission. We have been able to really build it into the leadership, build girls' voices into the leadership of the organization by providing a space where we, you know, the girls who graduate out of our other programs who want to continue to work with Hardy Girls can do so. So our Girls Advisory Board members do community service projects. They do fundraising for the organization. They completely plan, organize, and provide content for our annual girls' conference, which has more than 200 girls from around the state coming to it. And they do their presentations, and they provide all of the workshops. And it's just a phenomenal experience for us because, you know, those teen girls are so much hipper and cooler than we ever will be as adults, especially to middle school girls. But they, but it's a great experience for them to develop their own leadership, public speaking, and team building skills.
you know, it isn't easy. I've actually put on a conference for young people where they got to be the decision makers, and it's a commitment. Do you have any kind of lessons learned about, you know, working with girls in an advisory board that you can kind of share with folks?
Well, one sort of discreet example is that a couple of years ago we wanted to begin to recognize girls' voices in leadership and activism in the state of Maine. And so one of our co-creators had just been recognized in the Women's Hall of Fame, and so we're like, oh, there's no Girls' Hall of Fame here, so we should start one as part of the organization, and we can recognize a number of girls each year and, you know, give them awards and that sort of thing. So we went to our Girls Advisory Board and said, hey, what do you all think about this idea? And they were like, oh, Girls Hall of Fame sounds so stuffy and boring. They're like, why don't we call it the Girls Rock Awards? So now we're in our going to our third year of the Girls Rock Awards, where we now have, you know, a title and you know, award descriptions that are much more appealing to girls, to teen girls and preteen girls than we ever could have made it. So, I mean, that's a really important lesson for us. You know, additionally, our funders, you know, from a funding standpoint, want to know, you know, how our programming is informed. So on a macro level, you know, it was a really great decision for us to institutionalize these girls' voices. I mean, that was an important lesson for us to learn, because they want to know that that our programs are relevant and really impacting girls.
That's wonderful. And, you know, and I think one of the key things I'm pulling out of what you said is it's institutionalized, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not that the advisory board can, you know, meets once a year, but that you have them in kind of checkpoints that you work with them all throughout your work.
And that keeps it sustainable. And like Lori is saying, like, there's so few resources for mm-hmm. these types of things, and it really keeps it going.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think the other point, is, if I can just add one more thing, is that originally we thought, well, we'll just, you know, ask two high school age girls to be on the board of directors for the organization. And, you know, after talking with some girls about that, they thought, well, we want our own group, you know. And so, again, you have to, part of institutionalizing it is really creating that space. You know, that's not just, you know, in a token way, well, we have, you know, two girls on our board of directors. No, we have an entire group of girls devoted to leadership in the organization.
Yeah, and not just token leadership. That's wonderful.
Nice.
Well, let's get one more example, and I think if you go to the next slide, we have a policy example. And I apologize that the font is small, but we can go to the team up actually the link we put in for get in the game, right? Or get the game plan.
Game plan.
I love all the slogans. The game plan. Get in the game. The game plan.
It's all good.
And this is with Team Up for Youth. And, Corey, you mentioned AB 2404, which is actually California legislation that was signed into law. And I think it's a real interesting policy example when you think about norms for girls. I wanted to give you a chance to talk about it a little bit.
Sure. So, I mean, the whole point of it is to really limit the discrimination of girls' access to—is it to sports specifically? No, to
I think just athletic programs.
Athletic programs.
And basically,
yeah.
I think what I saw is that it's it prohibits cities, counties, and special districts from discriminating on the basis of gender in community athletic programs in parks and recreational facilities.
So awesome that it exists.
Mm-hmm.
And really, really significant. And there's no body actually overseeing, no physical
mm-hmm.
body and people's overseeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the challenges we as a state face, and one of the things that we're tackling, is how do you encourage
mm-hmm.
these bodies, these organizations to be serving girls? Because right now, like, if you go to park and rec centers, you'll see many, many boys and many fewer girls. And so
mm-hmm.
how do you help the staff get on board so they actually want to serve them? Or what are other things? Because there's nothing punitive. It's just, here's this policy. And so really trying to figure out how to work creatively with these different groups
mm-hmm.
so they actually see this through.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it seems like a real opportunity for some partnerships
yep.
Around youth development and some of these other pieces
yeah.
That Team Up for Youth can do. I mean, it seems like a great policy. I had never even thought about it before. We always talk about, equity and all these different ways. But, you know, our rec centers is a huge place. We think about youth development
yeah.
and all the great benefits that come out
especially
of that.
Especially in low-income communities, that's where kids are hanging out.
Definitely.
And so
mm-hmm.
you want to make sure the girls have access to the sports opportunities.
And yeah, I see that, yeah. Living in Oakland, like, I see kids, like, going to sports practice all the time, actually, in my neighborhood. It's really
mm-hmm.
great to see that, but where does the funding come from, and how do you make sure that they can access those areas? Yeah. Really important.
I think one of the things that we're working on in terms of AB 2404 is actually finding a rec site that is really interested in kind of making sure that there's not that disparity in who's being served and using them as a kind of a study site for other branches to use as a role model.
Great.
I also thought Paul's mentioning the benefit of universities and graduate programs to do internships, and I think, you know, that's a real interesting piece, and you guys work with universities quite a bit to get your work through, right?
Yep. Yeah, we work a lot with universities and a lot of different departments to access college students who really want to be in the community serving and working with youth, and specifically through sports.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really important partnership.
Oh, that's wonderful. All right, well, let's turn it over and more formally open up the text chat. All of you have been typing madly about organizational practices and policies that counter limited roles for girls and women. Oh, wait, a quick question about the Expect Respect resource. That's with Safe Place out of office.
I'll post the link. I posted the link earlier, and I'll post it again right now.
Great. Thank you.
Just have so much text chat going that you're just going to scroll up really quick.
Right. So sports available for fun, not just having to make a team in order to participate. Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I think that definitely influenced my – I'm competitive, but I'm a little intimidated by the whole – team competition. It's really fun to participate.
I was on the third string varsity basketball team, and I was so happy that I didn't have to play because I got to just hang out with my friends and wear the uniform.
Yeah. However, just as a pushback to that, it's so important that we are taking girls seriously and developing their skills.
Mm-hmm.
So we're making sports available that we really highlight. We're going to teach you these skills. We're going to have high expectations. This is the way we do with boys, and it can be fun, but like girls, you know, we want them to feel competitive. We want them to feel like they can excel. We want them to see that they have improved over time. And so often we see these drop-in programs or these programs that say they're sports programs, and it's really doing a disservice to the girls because they're not developing their skills and they're not getting hooked and they're not actually getting those benefits. So it's a balance.
I saw the comment here about the school public policy and looking at sexual harassment among students, and I think that's one of the things that folks have really talked about is not just, you know, what does the campus look like, what kind of images are around the campus, what kind of activities are around campus. We talked about the university example of the policy of the date auctions, and schools really have an opportunity to set policy around, you know, what that environment looks like when young people are spending so much time in there.
And it's a new arena, too, right now, especially with technology and the fact that the Internet and having a smartphone or having a cell phone, period, that's, you know, people are talking about having instilling that school policy to ban all cell phones that may reduce the amount of bullying and the harassment going on. I think, Annie, you had that really interesting story about picture messaging or something. There's a lot of studies that have been done around the media and the increased technology influencing how many girls get harassed and bullied via cell phones.
Right. I also saw that, you know, dedicating resources is a really important organizational practice. I mean, I think that is especially difficult as the economy and organizations really are doing a lot of cutting back. I think that's something that we have to just maintain. And I paused because I almost said fight to maintain, and then I don't want to fight to maintain it, but advocate for maintaining it. Great. Well, it looks like our policy examples are a little bit thinner in this area, and I think that's interesting, too, that we are more comfortable at that kind of individual education, a little bit more at the coalition level, and are still learning about what this looks like at the policy level.
Somebody a lot earlier mentioned that in Canada, parents get a tax credit. I don't know who it was that someone was typing in, that they get a tax credit when they sign their children, I think it's just children in general, up for sports, which is such an amazing thing that exists in Canada, and how amazing if in this country we had something like that, which really encouraged parents and really placed a value on signing kids up for sports.
Right.
Well, especially youth development-based sports.
Right. Well, and parental leave practices that supported parents that wanted to get their kids involved in sports. Absolutely. All right, well, I think it's really helpful to think through this, and I always appreciate the conversation here, and the strategy examples are so rich. But we would be remiss if we didn't take time to think about how to measure the success of these great ideas.
Great, exactly. And, you know, if these types of things, you know, we're looking to achieve implementing policy strategies, organizational practices, the question is, how do we measure the progress towards those visions and goals. So we wanted to switch gears and talk about indicators here.
Right. So, you know, it's really important to know how to measure your progress effectively in order to keep your work going forward, especially when you're talking about budgets. And I think Megan and Corey, you both talked about how important it is to document what you're doing to your funders, right? So we discussed in our last forum about countering men's and boys, you know, there's different indicators you can look to measure progress, and you can do that kind of at each level of the spectrum. Today we wanted just to focus on just kind of two levels as we look at indicators.
So we are sharing here with you some sample school indicators that can show that we are moving that needle, like we had that great image on the previous slide, moving that needle towards progress and towards change in school settings. So some of those indicators include reduced incidences of sexual harassment and bullying, increased feelings of attachment, commitment to school, having that positive school climate and feeling of safety, the implementation of positive, comprehensive sexual health and relationship education curriculum at schools, and increased equity and funding, like we've been talking about very in depth, for boys and girls sports teams and other extracurricular activities.
Right, and I think people said, you know, it's not just sports, right?
We brought
sports in as an example, and it's an important one where women are gaining, you know, more ground. I watched the NBA finals, which took me right into FIFA World Cup, and I realized in preparing this that I don't watch as much, you know, women's sports as a feminist as I would like to.
Well, it's just not there.
Yeah, and it's just not there, right? So you think about these indicators, and, you know, what would indicators you would want to see at your school level? And then we also thought about community-level indicators. And we thought maybe, let's keep going. I think that this should be, we want to do community-level indicators. And one of the things we talked about is, you know, increased hope and opportunity with young women. We can ask those questions in a lot of our standard-based schools, community safety, sexually suggestive advertising, equal involvement. And one of the things I put up here is, you know, I saw someone mention a program in St. Louis about girls and women in local government and other leadership roles, and using that as maybe one of your indicators as well. I was thinking, you know, Megan, did you want to comment a little bit about how you measure success with kind of hearty environments through your organization?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the programs we've had a lot of success measuring is our middle school girls coalition groups, which is based off of our curriculum Adversaries to Allies, and it's billed, you know, for schools as a girl fighting prevention program, but it's really about, again, creating that safe space for girls to dissect some of these cultural messages and to work together to speak back. So, you know, how do we measure our indicators? We use a number of sort of scientific scales, the depression scale and the feminine ideology scale, which measure to what extent girls are buying into feminine ideology. And what we find is that, girls report more self-knowledge, increased perspective taking, a heightened cultural critique. They report more positive feelings about themselves, which speaks to the self-esteem issue. They're more likely to be able to break down stereotypes. They have better conflict negotiation and relational skills, and we see this play out both in a qualitative and quantitative way, where girls are reporting better relationships in their families. Girls learn to be allies to one another, and we can measure that through, you know, our interviews, our post-group interviews with girls. And then they, you know, again, they have better relationships with family members and peers.
Oh, it sounds amazing. Did you have anything that you didn't feel like were good measures, kind of lessons learned from your evaluation? I think sometimes we focus on all the things that, you know, worked for us and forget to mention the things that didn't actually depict what the change we saw was.
That's a great question. I'm not sure off the top of my head what the answer is.
What I'm thinking of, and I wasn't being explicit, is sometimes we measure self-esteem, and sometimes we find that self-esteem in groups of young people that aren't actually doing very well is still very high. They have these hyperinflated self-esteem that actually doesn't translate to their ability. We asked a question of young people when I was working at the after-school program if they were planning to go to college. That was one of our pieces. And, you know, they were in the program, and yes, yes, yes. But if you ask them the question what their grades were, they all had straight D's and F's, right? So I actually wasn't getting them to college. I was inspiring them, but I was setting them up for incredible failure. And I realized that through my evaluation, that I wasn't necessarily asking the right question in terms of, you know, are they really prepared to go to college? Well, I'm missing a piece there, you know?
So it's almost as though they're reporting what you want them to say.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, and that's the reason that we use actually three different scales when we measure, because I think that that can help us get to, you know, you can sort of look at the disparity then, you know, if they're reporting that they have a heightened critique of feminine ideology but a lower self-esteem or vice versa, then you can certainly figure that out. But, you know, it's also why we pair quantitative with qualitative evaluation, is so that we can talk with the girls as well. About the change that they're experiencing.
Yeah.
And they can give specific examples.
Great.
Yeah.
So do we want to turn it over to the audience, to your participants, and ask you what are indicators that you think will measure, or that you know will measure, progress towards countering limited roles for girls and women in communities?
Yeah, and I think that the slide says schools, but we actually want to look at schools and communities. We wanted to tie those two together. And I realized slides moving all over the place. All right. So this is a difficult question for us. This isn't something that I think we've had as a field really good experience doing in kind of terms of countering norms. And so, you know, let's think through this together. If anyone has a comment or a kind of a lesson learned or something they want to share by phone, I would really encourage you. We wanted to set aside time this time for people to be able to speak. Please raise your hand. We do have another at least 10 minutes here, and we really do want to kind of have a minute to discuss this. So it's hard for me to discuss. Well, Christine and I could talk all day, but we'd love to open it up for you. So we have some lots of great examples coming in here. So girls' leadership in schools, you can measure that.
Less teen pregnancies was mentioned. It's really great.
Oh, that's an interesting one. It kind of goes to other outcomes as well.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that Annie Casey reported that teen pregnancies are going up for the first time in a long time in some communities, and they were a little concerned about that. Female-to-female bullying, that's a great one. We talked about kind of relational aggression and kind of the impact on that and some opportunities within that.
People have been talking a lot about increased participation, whether it's in, like, just in community volunteer positions, or I think there are some, you know, the girls' group programs, things like that. Those are definitely measurable.
And Melanie put in a wider expression of gender identity and sexuality, and I wonder how would folks measure that? I think that's really, you know, that's what our goal is, right? Is that we have a wider expression, that people see different opportunities, and so they see a much broader version of who they can be, especially with some of those negative pieces. I'd wonder how we measure it. Girls dressing more modestly. That's interesting, Patricia.
Increased parent involvement in new programs and at schools and various programs, I think, is definitely a good indicator.
I think I'm seeing Cliff's discussion is flying up the thing. Girls' participation in classroom is typified as masculine. We were doing a training the other day, and a woman said, you know, I supervise all these people, and for me, I have to tie into my male side in order to do that. And everyone in the room kind of paused, and she said, I can't believe I just said that. You know, it was a violence against women training.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we still, as women, have internalized those things and thinking about how do we explicitly make leadership feminine and what does that look like.
Mm-hmm.
Decreased alcohol and drug use, interesting.
Is there anyone out there that would like to speak with us via phone? Because we would love to hear from you.
Oh. And David, you know, you've been quiet on this topic, and I know this is something near and dear to your heart. What do you see as kind of the field right now?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting when we look at prevention around violence against women, in that in the last several years, there's been a lot of focus on, that's not me, that's sad. I pushed the wrong button. There's been a lot of emphasis on engaging men and boys, and I think that one of the things that we've, but historically, our work has always been, has been really coming from the foundation of the work with women and girls, and that we really need to look at ways, and I like the way that Megan, you talked about, and both Megan and Corey talked about, that the role is not just about engaging women and girls, but also then having them being able to take active roles within their communities to create change. And that if we want to be able to change the cultures that, you know, that clearly women and girls are, play an important role in that, and that's, I think, what's exciting as we look at our youth leadership efforts and seeing ways that youth are involved, and that we need to make sure that women and girls have a role that are plays a very important role in being able to help shape our communities. And so that's what I think is really exciting about these efforts. And I think that the challenge for us is to make sure that we keep the links to the issues of sexual violence and intimate partner violence, but not limit ourselves to the issues of sexual violence
exactly.
and domestic violence. And I think that's why we picked these two programs today, is because while they're not necessarily explicit around those issues, though I think Hardy Girls Healthy Women talks about that quite a bit, these programs are absolutely in line with being able to change the conditions that will reduce violence against women.
Right. And I think when you talk about that youth leadership piece, you know, we all know youth leadership is a great idea. We all know, you know, having youth on an advisory board are a great idea, and that's been a norms change. I think the question for folks right now is how to do that effectively and what are kind of the best practices about that. You know, how do you get funding for things like that? And, you know, I just want to acknowledge it's really hard when you do this primary prevention work to sometimes get funding for things, especially through Violence Against Women channels, to do this kind of change work up front. And that's one of the reasons working in partnership is so important.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking through, we've had some really interesting pieces, lateral leadership as opposed to hierarchical models.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested in consensus building instead of kind of the voting or the other piece that we do in our organizations. I think that's an interesting piece.
I love girls wearing less makeup and boys wearing more makeup.
Okay. If you didn't know, if you know our executive director, he showed up for work on Monday with blue fingernail polish on half of one hand, which I said is a whole new male gender. I didn't even know what that meant. But apparently he had a wonderful weekend with his nephew, which you can imagine is just a wonderful thing when you think about roles for young men and women.
And then I see Carla talks about we need a female president.
Yeah. Well, you know,
that was an interesting presidential race we had.
It was hard, right? But I think, you know, when you think about a female president, that is, you know, that's the school body, that's the local body, that's
mm-hmm.
the PTA, that it's not just about our national leadership, but it's all these organizations that we belong to, and how are we ensuring girls have a leadership role? I think about one of our past guests from Des Moines that talked about, you know, we're growing our next advocate. I'm training them within our organization. Our young people are intricately involved with that decision-making so they can be that next advocacy. And we can do that in our church groups, our neighborhood groups.
Mm-hmm.
We can do it in pretty much any type of work we do if we make the space. It doesn't happen organically. And that's one of the things I really appreciate about this group. And I'm so glad 40% of you are back again, because I feel like this is a community of people that are committed to figuring out how to make this happen. I saw Tasha mention boys being the color pink as well.
The color, for goodness sake.
I know, right. And not reinforcing gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Right.
Well, I mean, I really do see that the engaging girls and women is an important part of primary prevention. I think that the shift from moving from, as we talked earlier, away from the risk reduction models
mm-hmm.
of how to, you know, focusing solely on how girls are to protect themselves, that's my fingers are up in quotes,
right.
to being able to look at how girls and women are going to be changing our culture is the place that we need to be continuing doing. And these are great examples of ways. And obviously sports and is only one of the functions, but they're one of the ways that we need to be able to move forward.
Yeah. And I think, too, there's some real interesting models that are looking in communities of color and other marginalized groups, and we've heard some bits about heterosexism today and, the, you know, the initiating conversations. I'm seeing Melanie's comment about sex diversity. And I think, you know, that's this next piece, and Gail followed up right well with the Angry Dykes comment. And you think about, you know, what does it look like for a woman to solve conflict and kind of the mean girls and kind of the angry guys? There's a lot of places for us to go. And what's great is that we're here having this conversation, hearing from people doing the work, that we're not doing this work in isolation. The Hardy Girls is in Maine, but they're partnering with other folks to do a conference in New York. And I hope that a young woman I know is going to join their virtual committee. And, Megan, you didn't mention that, but you can participate virtually with Spark, right?
You can, yes. And we're working on getting a website up for the summit. But in the meantime, folks could find Spark Summit on Facebook or also just check back at the Hardy Girls website for updates.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And we shared that website with everybody, and that will be – we could post that again if people are interested.
Yeah, we can put that up. That's no problem. Megan, do you have any final words as we wrap up today? Anything you want to add for folks?
You know, I'm really appreciative of Prevent Connect and the Prevention Institute and all the work that you're doing. I think it's important for us, as we all do programming for girls and for boys, to not focus on just reinforcing those gender stereotypes and incorporating girls into the social order. We really need to support girls' voices and leadership and, you know, support them breaking out of these gender stereotypes. So, you know, I appreciate all the work that everybody who's on this call is doing on the ground in their own communities. It's inspiring to read the chats and to see where you're all coming from.
Yeah. And then, Corey, did you have some final comments today?
I love the conversation about how are we expanding our idea of what it means to be a girl, what it means to be a woman. And I think, you know, whether you're talking about sports or other areas, like how do we let it be a complicated definition and let there be a lot of space? So, again, I keep coming back to sports because that's the area that I'm working in right now. But when we talk about how to be strong and feminine and how those actually can be one and the same, and that conversation can just happen kind of across the board. And I think it's a really – it says a lot that we can have that conversation now that we're talking about violence prevention from that place versus the kind of intervention models.
Yeah. No, I think this field has come a long way because of the commitment and the discussions and people really thinking through, you know, what is this going to take, and that we can't just do intervention. And as important that as it is, we have to start thinking about these environments for women and for girls, and also what we're teaching boys. And we didn't talk about that as much today, but really, you know, how does the messages about girls influence boys' behavior?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big piece of this.
Mm-hmm.
Christine, do you want to add any final comments as we wrap up today?
I just like to thank everybody for their active participation. I think it's been a really rich discussion. We've heard some really great suggestions, and I learned a lot from what people are suggesting. I didn't know a lot of these existed, and I think that's the beauty of this web conference, and that we can continue the discussion and keep sharing those resources and finding new ways to counter norms.
Yeah. David?
Well, great. Well, I just want to thank, I want to once again thank Corey and Megan for joining us, and I want to thank Annie and Christine from Prevention Institute. You will be getting an evaluation in your email in approximately 2 minutes, so please take another minute and fill that out. That's helpful for us.
Oh, wait. Carla just mentioned something really important.
Carla.
Remember your purchasing power and who you support as a consumer. Thank you, Carla.
Yeah.
Those would be remiss. I'm sorry, David.
That's great, and I'd love to see the networking going across Canada from Montreal to British Columbia.
I love it.
That's been going on, and continue these discussions on Twitter, on Facebook, in our listservs, with each other as you're trading messages. This is a theme that we're going to continue to be able to address and be able to support. So I want to really thank you. If you want to get a copy of the PowerPoints, it's on the Prevent Connect website. We do have a copy there. I posted them last night, and we've got some great opportunities to be able to do this discussion. We will be repeating this session. It might be a little different because people might go differently. We'll repeat the session next week. So if you have friends or colleagues that you want to have get this, have them go to preventconnect.org and sign up, because that it will fill up, I imagine, but we want you to be able to let people know that that's available. So let's go ahead and do that. So thank you so much. We will keep the text chat open for a couple more minutes. We will put a copy of the text chat. You'll probably go up next week around this. And we look forward to being able to see you all online in the future. And for those of you coming to the National Sexual Assault Conference soon, we look forward to seeing you there too. So thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you all.
Thank
Bye.
You everyone.
This concludes.
This does conclude today's presentation. Thank you everyone for your participation.